I next met with Dr. Philippe Armand, and to begin, he commented on the fascinating and rapidly evolving clinical research database on checkpoint inhibitors in hematologic cancers.
The biology is very disease-specific. The most, in my mind to date, the most interesting biological basis has been in classical Hodgkin lymphoma, because about 6 years ago, the papers came out showing that classical Hodgkin lymphoma, basically almost always, we now know it's a nearly universal event, has a genetic deregulation on the short arm of chromosome 9, and the targets of that deregulation event are the PD-1 ligands, PD-L1 and PD-L2. So there's a lot of other stuff around that biology, but there was a very strong reason to believe that Hodgkin lymphoma could be uniquely susceptible to PD-1 blockade because of its biology. And that did not, at least at first, appear to be the case in other hematologic malignancies, or in fact, in solid tumors. This was really a new finding. And the clinical results that have come out over the last couple of years have really borne out this hypothesis. We now have phase 1 studies with both nivolumab and pembrolizumab, and now preliminary phase 2 results that are presented at ASCO and EHA, really showing phenomenal response rates. So the response rates with the two agents are around 60 to 80% in heavily pretreated patients. So those are patients typically who failed autotransplant, failed brentuximab, or transplant ineligible. And so in Hodgkin lymphoma, there was kind of a unique story of biology driving responses. In parallel, there has been a lot of testing across other tumors, some of which were selected because of PD-L1 expression, like myeloma, some of which were selected just because of the interest of checking the pathway, like other forms of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And the results have been less strong in other tumors. The myeloma results from the phase 1 NEVO study showed no responses with single-agent drug. I think out of 27 patients, the objective response rate was 0%. And what's happened in myeloma, which is also interesting, is that despite the lack of single-agent activity, the drugs have been combined, in particular with IMiDs. So there were a couple of abstracts at ASH last year, notably using pembrolizumab in combination with either lenalidomide or pomalidomide. And actually high response rate, up to 75% in one of those studies, including in refractory patients. So it's interesting because here's a drug with no apparent single-agent activity, at least a pathway with no apparent single-agent activity, and yet in combination can induce responses even in IMiD-refractory patients.
And of course, you know, not that it's necessarily related, but we did see that, for example, with elotuzumab and myeloma
exactly.
For whatever reason. But, you know, seeing that data in myeloma made me think, you know, about this idea, you know, sort of the IMiDs seem to crop up where you least expect them. But, you know, the idea of an IMiD and a PD-1 antibody kind of makes sense. I think, has it been looked at like in solid tumors, for example?
Not that I know of in solid tumors. So there's been, in general, on the heels of the initial results, there's been a huge interest in combination therapy. And I think for me, that's probably where the field is headed. Even in Hodgkin lymphoma, there's work on combination. It's clear in most of the heme malignancies that we've studied, where the results are public, that PD-1 blockade by itself is not a slam dunk. There are some diseases like follicular lymphoma where there's some durable responses, but overall, it doesn't have huge single-agent activity except for a very few scattered histologies. But there's a lot of potential for combo therapy, and IMiDs in particular are very interesting, and likely we're going to see the results of combination of IMiDs with PD-1 even outside of myeloma. But there hasn't been, to my knowledge, any solid tumor data on that combination.
You know, before we get back to Hodgkin, just, you know, continuing on this idea of combinations, I mean, you hear this in everything, you know, lung cancer or whatever. I mean, but conceptually, what kinds of combinations make the most sense to you? We talked about IMiDs. What about chemotherapy, radiation therapy, targeted therapy, et cetera?
So really, all of the above, for better or for worse. So now there are actually good preclinical models showing that even conventional chemotherapy has immunogenic effect and can sensitize tumors to checkpoint blockade. Like, there was a recent paper in a lung cancer model showing that a platinum agent can make the tumor sensitive to a subsequent checkpoint blockade. So there's interest in combining conventional chemo with checkpoint blockade. We've seen already in some of the clinical trials, we've seen anecdotally these abscopal effects with radiation. So there are patients on study. There's one who's reported with myeloma on the nivolumab study, who had stable disease with nivolumab and then developed a site of clinical progression, was radiated at that site and achieved a CR elsewhere. And we've seen that in lymphoma as well, at least anecdotally. So now there are clinical trials that are going to explore that formally, the combination of radiotherapy and checkpoint blockade. And then there's also a lot of interest in combining checkpoint with checkpoint. So that's been done, as you well know, in melanoma with very powerful indication of synergy. And there have been trials already conducted in lymphoma and additional trials that are planned combining different checkpoint. Although we don't yet have in heme malignancies, we don't really have a sense of what the right synergies are for this. We don't know enough about the biology of checkpoint in heme malignancies to understand what pathways we should target in parallel. There are some animal models, as you know, in solid tumors, which have suggested some combination like PD-1-CTLA-4 or PD-1-TIM-3, but we don't really have a lot of data in heme malignancy. So part of that work is proceeding in a, I guess, biologically agnostic fashion, if you will.
Also, I was thinking about a conversation I had with Chuck Drake of Hopkins, and he was talking about other checkpoints, and I see you're involved with the trial, something he was telling me about, anti-LAG-3. What are some of the other checkpoint inhibitors out there?
There are a huge number of them now. There's LAG-3, which is being targeted both in heme and in solid tumors. Certainly CTLA-4, PD-1, TIM-3, OX-40, GITR, and more. It's a really fast expanding field, and we already have many, 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 many more possible combinations than we can ever dream to test.
You know, reflecting back on the biology we're talking about with Hodgkin lymphoma, you know, rarely do you see histology in action. And clearly there's this classic, you know, weird thing we've always seen with Hodgkin, with Reed Sternberg, et cetera. How do you connect those two things together?
It actually connects really well, right? So the pathology, as you allude to, of Hodgkin lymphoma is there are these isolated tumor cells, the Reed Sternberg cells, and instead of growing in sheets like in some other tumors or lymphomas, they're completely isolated. They're isolated from each other, and they're surrounded by an inflammatory infiltrate. And yet, so somehow, there must be a way for the immune system to see the tumor, but it's not effective at eradicating it. And that's puzzled people for a long time. What is it about Hodgkin that allows this kind of immune evasion? And now the PD-1 story provides at least a possibility. It's probably much more complex than that even, because we know that there's a lot of PD-L1 in the microenvironment of Hodgkin, and that there's some interaction between the PD-L1 in the tumor cell and PD-L1 in the microenvironment. So we don't know exactly what the distal effects of the genetic events are, and we don't know really what the mechanism of action of the drugs are.
And, you know, I mentioned we particularly target general oncologists with this series. And, of course, they're seeing this story played out in so many different kinds of cancers. And, you know, I take a step back in their position and say, well, what does this all have in common? So another thing that comes up is, you know, viral issues. And so with Hodgkin, it's EBV, head and neck, you know, HPV. Where does that sort of fit in?
It's an interesting question. So EBV positivity is still true only in a minority of classical Hodgkin lymphoma. It turns out EBV infection leads to PD-L1 expression. So there's a genetic link because of activation pathways. So in fact, EBV may provide a complementary mechanism for PD-L1 expression, particularly in Hodgkin, but Hodgkin probably doesn't need a complementary mechanism because almost all tumors have this 9P24 amplification. But another setting where this is interesting is in large cell lymphoma, where the drug by itself don't seem to be that effective. And yet in EBV-positive large cell lymphoma, those tumors turn out to more frequently be PD-L1 positive, and it may be that the drugs are more effective there, although we don't know that formally yet. So I think it's interesting because it suggests that in EBV-positive tumors may have a higher response rate to PD-1 blockade. But certainly in the case of Hodgkin lymphoma, most patients who respond don't have EBV. And we know that even from the phase 1 studies, most of those patients were not EBV-positive and yet responded.
So, of course, nivolumab is now approved in HL. Can you sort of overview what the clinical data, you alluded to the response, et cetera, but can you kind of compare the data that's available for nivolumab to other PD-1 inhibitors, particularly pembrolizumab, and do you see other agents, including pembrolizumab, becoming approved in HL?
So I think the two agents have run sort of neck to neck. The development of nivolumab in classical Hodgkin lymphoma preceded that of pembrolizumab. So the phase 1 result came out a little bit earlier. There's about a 6 months or more lead time on the Nivo phase 1. So we know a little bit more about durability of responses. And then both Nivo and Pembro had very similar registration phase 2 studies, which in the case of nivolumab was used for the FDA approval. pembrolizumab, as you know, doesn't yet have an official approval, just the breakthrough designation. But the phase two, that is a registration study for pembrolizumab, was presented in preliminary fashion along with the results of the first cohort of phase two for nivolumab. So based on what we know so far, the results seem very similar. They enroll slightly different population. The phase two nivolumab study was all three cohorts were patients who had previously received an auto transplant. Pembrolizumab has a cohort, which is, I think they're cohort two, which is transplant ineligible patient, which is interesting because that does include a substantial fraction of patients with refractory Hodgkin lymphoma who weren't included on the phase two study or on the label for nivolumab. And clearly, based on the results that were just shown at ASCO and EHA, pembrolizumab seems to be as effective in this population as in the post-transplant population. So I think, you know, we're likely to see, I imagine that there may be similar types of approvals, although the labels could be slightly different because the trial populations were slightly different.
What about other checkpoint inhibitors, anti-PD-L1, atezolizumab is now approved? Have these agents been looked at in HL?
So not yet formally. We don't have any results for PD-L1 blockade. And it's another very interesting question which comes up because from the beginning, there was this thought of whether it would be more effective to block at the receptor level through PD-1 or at the ligand level. And our take had been that it might make more sense to block at the receptor level. The reason for that is all these genetic events also involve PD-L2. So if you look at the surface of the Reed-Sternberg cell, there's PD-L2 on the surface as well. And we don't know whether that is influential in the survival of Hodgkin lymphoma, but given that, you'd say, well, it probably makes sense to target PD-1, which will block both interactions. There's one anecdotal event, which I think is instructive in this, which is in the phase one study of nivolumab, there was a patient with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, because this was a sort of pan-lymphoma study, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma who, on studies of biopsy, turned out to have a translocation involving PD-L2. So if you look at that patient's tumor, there was no PD-L1, but there was strong PD-L2. That patient achieved a partial remission with PD-1 blockade. That's a rare event in lymphoma. Those PD-L2 translocations have been described in other entities, but they're rare, so it's not going to lead to strong response rate, but if we want to capture those, one would think that we should target at the receptor level. The counter-argument is that there are drugs like the PD-L1 antibodies that you mentioned, those will bind at the tumor itself. And it's kind of like elotuzumab that you mentioned, is if you bind at the tumor, you may have additional effects besides blockade of the PD-1 pathway. It's conceivable that there could be direct tumoricidal activity from actually targeting the tumor, even though that's not really the intent. But there could be ADCC or other mechanisms which make those drugs as effective. It's conceivable they could be more effective than PD-1 blockade, but we don't have any way to make those determinations yet.
At one point, I was hearing things about that because of this differential activity, that maybe anti-PD-L1 agents that would have less pulmonary toxicity. I don't know how much of an issue, you know, obviously with Hodgkin, with the chemo, you know, that's an issue. Is that something that's played out?
An excellent question. That was a worry initially in those studies because of the patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. Many of them have had radiation or brentuximab or a BCNU with auto transplant. And so there was a concern that we would see a lot of pneumonitis in this population. It doesn't seem to be. It's possible that there's a slightly increased risk of pneumonitis in general in lymphoma compared to solid tumors, but the rates have been pretty low. And if you look at the phase two data that was reported, the incidence of pneumonitis were quite low. It could be a little bit higher than solid tumor, but not really, not significantly so and not concerningly so. So I don't think that's unlikely in my mind to provide a meaningful impetus for studying PD-L1 over PD-1, at least that particular question of pneumonitis.
And I'm assuming that in contrast to melanoma and lung cancer, that actual PD-1 levels in the tissue are really not looked at or considered with HL because they're all so high?
Right. There's no PD-1 on the tumor cell. There's PD-1 in the infiltrating lymphocytes, but that hasn't yet been correlated with anything that we know of.
What about toxicity? We talked a little bit about pulmonary toxicity. Anything unusual or different observed with HL compared to solid tumors, for example?
No. I think overall the experience in heme malignancies has been that the safety profile of both drugs is similar to that in solid tumors. So it's a relatively low drug-related severe toxicity. It's about 20%, I think, in both studies of grade 3-4 related toxicities, but probably about half of those are lab events. So there's nothing yet that stands out as being a sort of lymphoma-specific or HM-specific toxicity. You know, that may come out of more work in the large phase two studies, but so far there's no indication that the safety profile is really different.
Another clinical issue that's been much discussed in all different cancers is the question of the patient with prior autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, et cetera. But here, you know, the stakes are even higher because the response rates are so higher. I think the first time I saw any data on PD-1 in autoimmune disease, I think it was in melanoma at ASCO, but there's very little data out there. I think there was some on ipilimumab previously. What about the issue of prior autoimmune disease, and how are you approaching that in your own practice?
Well, fortunately, it's a rare issue. And as you say, it's interesting. So those patients were obviously all excluded from clinical trials, so we have no data on them. But as you mentioned, there is now emerging in the solid tumor literature some descriptions of patients with prior autoimmune disease who get on PD-1 or CTLA-4 blockade. And what I see of it, the message is that it's doable, although there's certainly a risk of toxicity. And there have been some descriptions of significant toxicity, including this recent report of a patient with kidney transplant, as you remember, who got pembrolizumab and led to allograft rejection as well. Now, it's a little bit of a different setting, but the other setting that we've seen it already in the lymphoma world is with allotransplant, where we really worry about immune toxicity. And there have been patients who've been treated with PD-1 blockade pre or post allo who've developed severe immune toxicity. But as you say, there's a flip side, which is when you get to the point where the patient has refractory disease, has no other option, and you have drugs with 60 to 80% response rate and durable responses, it is a conversation that I think can be had with the patient to say, well, there is a heightened risk of immune toxicity, which may be even higher in someone with previous autoimmune disease and risk of exacerbation of that disease. But on the other hand, if the alternative is to die of Hodgkin lymphoma, I think it's at least a reasonable conversation to have.
Let's talk about sort of the placement of a PD-1 antibody. At this point, it's nivolumab in the management of HL specifically. Can you kind of go through exactly what the indication is right now and where you think you'd like to use it? And does that match up with where it's indicated? In other words, would you want to use it in other situations?
So the label following the cohort, the study 205, which was a nivolumab phase 2 study, is in patients who failed prior auto and brentuximab. So to use the drug according to label, the patient has to have gone through auto and gone through brentuximab. And I think it's very nice to have a drug available for those patients because there's very little out there now that's effective in that setting. So for patients in that situation, it's by far the best therapeutic option that we have, unquestionably at this point. Because the only drug that rivals nivolumab, in this case, in activity in Hodgkin lymphoma is brentuximab, and the label is for brentuximab failure. So in that setting, there's nothing that really competes with PD-1 blockade at the moment. But it's not really the population that we want to target. This is such a powerful new therapeutic strategy. We want to use it to cure patients, not necessarily to give it to patients who failed everything else. So there's now a slew of studies that are starting to use PD-1 blockade in first line, in first salvage. We're also doing a post-auto study of PD-1 blockade. So all the previous steps at which one could potentially position this kind of treatment are being explored. Now, that's not, obviously, it's not a labeled indication. Those are all clinical trials. My hope is that that's where the drug will find a place, is earlier to improve cure rate. That's what I'd like to see.
But just to be clear, though, for the patient who has relapsed disease but is not a candidate for transplant, older patient, et cetera, where does nivolumab under the current label fit in?
Well, so for reasons that we can't talk about here, the phase 2 nivolumab study did not include patients who were transplant ineligible. So that's not on the label. As we mentioned earlier, the pembrolizumab phase 2 study has a dedicated cohort for transplant ineligible patients. So if that makes its way into a future label, then pembro could be used on label for this patient population. For me, there's no reason to not use a drug. I mean, no clinical reason to not use a drug in that setting because we know it works from the phase 2 pembro study. We know it works from the phase 1 study of nivo and pembro. And this is a very desperate patient population. If they can't get to transplant because they have chemorefractory disease, or if they can't get to transplant because they're older and have relapsed refractory disease, there's very little available. So I think outside of the label issue, it's certainly, I think, a good population to use a drug with.
But for practical purposes, have you tried to access a nivo, for example, in a patient who's not had a transplant, and have you been successful?
Well, we've had the good fortune that we've had a lot of participation in all those clinical trials and in ongoing trials. So we haven't really very much run against the issue of not being able to get the drug because most of the patient can be on one of the clinical trials. We've used the drug off-label in a variety of settings, including in other diseases like mediastinal lymphoma, which we didn't talk about yet, and patients with Hodgkin lymphoma who, for whatever reason, couldn't be on clinical trial. So I think we have seen a willingness on the part of payers to sort of stray from the label. And we've used PD-1 blockade off-label before the FDA approval, and many others have too. Another setting, which we alluded to earlier, is the post-allo setting. There's a sort of a burgeoning experience, including some of which, has been publicly reported in case series, of using PD-1 blockade post-allo, which is certainly not in the label either, but another desperate situation where people have had success in getting the drug available, whether it's Nivo or Pembro.
Yeah, the idea of using a PD-1 antibody in somebody either before they get an allo or particularly after, seems sort of challenging. What happens?
Well, so it's a complex question, obviously. There's actually data with CTLA-4. So there have been two clinical trials with CTLA-4 blockade in patients with relapsed hematologic malignancies after allo. One which was published in 2009 and one which is being published now, which is in press. And on both trials, there actually is a response rate. The first trial had a response rate of about 10% with low-dose, single-dose IPI. The current trial, which Matt Davids is going to publish soon, is a repeated dose IPI at higher dose. In the high dose cohort, the response rate was over 30%. There is some toxicity, but for the most part, the toxicity has been manageable in terms of immune-related AEs or GVHD. So we know CTLA-4 blockade can be effective in that setting. PD-1 is different because the PD-1 biology after allo is very tricky. But there is this anecdotal experience in treating particularly Hodgkin lymphoma patients who've relapsed after allo. And so far, what we see is there is some toxicity, there's some GVH, there have been some anecdotal reports of severe immune-related toxicity, but many patients respond. That is being captured now. There's a registry that's opening up through the CIBMTR of trying to basically capture all this off-label experience that so many people are doing to see what's the response rate, what's the safety, et cetera. We're actually also doing a trial of this so that we can study this formally. And you're right, it's a little bit of a daunting experiment to do, but we're targeting, at least in this step, patients who have relapsed malignancy after allo. That's a very, very tough problem to solve. If people relapse after allo, there's very little usually that's available to them. So it's another setting like the one with autoimmune disease where we say, well, probably the benefit of the drug may outweigh its risks.
What would you expect a PD-1 antibody to do in terms of graft versus host disease?
I'd expect it to increase it. The question is, by how much and in whom? You know, most of these patients, because their post-allo relapses are already several months out from allo, where the effect of PD-1 blockade may be different. It seems like, based on the biology of PD-1, that there may be something in the early post-transplant period that's really critical, particularly by PD-L1, in terms of maintaining acute graft versus host disease homeostasis. But the question really, at least for me, is not whether the drug will cause any GVH. I'm sure it will. Whether it'll cause immune toxicity, I'm sure it will. The question is, can it provide a benefit that outweighs its toxicity? And that's an investigational question. There was also a paper that was just published recently, a very interesting paper from Bruce Blazer's group, who's elucidated a lot of the biology of PD-1 in the allo setting, showing that, in fact, the PD-1 on the donor T cell is important in mediating exhaustion, whereas the previous work has shown that PD-L1 on the recipient parenchymal cell is important protecting against graft versus host disease. So there are all these differential effects of PD-1 in the allo setting, which makes it biologically a fascinating field, clinically a landmine field, but I think it's one in which, willing or not, we're going to have to learn to tread.
I know there's a lot of interest. I think you're involved with a trial looking at the combination of bevacizumab and PD-1 antibody, which really makes a lot of sense. What do we know about that right now at this point?
Nothing, just interest. And really, it's, again, scientifically, it's completely open question. It could go both ways because CD30 is a T-cell target as well. So saying, well, we're targeting CD30 because it works in Hodgkin, not because of what it does to the immune system, but we don't know what that combination is going to do. However, in the case of Hodgkin lymphoma, if you have two drugs with, you know, this high response rate, they're sort of begging to be combined at some point. So that's what's happening now.
I'm curious how you're using bevacizumab in your practice in terms of Hodgkin lymphoma. I get a lot of questions from oncologists about it in the pre-transplant setting and the post-transplant consolidation setting and the relapse setting. How do you think about bevacizumab in those different settings?
So I personally don't use it up front because we don't have the data from the Echelon study which will inform that question. And I don't use it in first relapse treatment. The data out there, so the data for single agent brentuximab in relapse Hodgkin lymphoma to me is not strong enough to justify using it over more conventional treatments like ICE or GND. There are these combination studies, particularly brentuximab bendamustine, that was presented at ASH a year and a half ago, which had very high response rates and CR rates that are better than what we expect with conventional salvage. But there's also toxicity with that approach. And I think until we learn more about it and really the post-auto outcome, it's not something that I use preferentially. So I think for me, in the salvage setting, brentuximab remains a sort of second salvage tool or third salvage tool. There's also data from Memorial and others about combining brentuximab with ICE, which are also interesting, or City of Hope. But as of yet, for me, I don't use it in preference to conventional salvage. Post-auto, I tend to follow the Athira data, again, with some uncertainty really as to what it does. We have a strong PFS benefit that's been demonstrated in that study. We don't know whether that translates to an increased cure rate, but I think it's a reasonable preliminary assumption, and that fortunately we can do now on label. And then in the patients with relapsed disease after auto transplant, I think now we have another option with PD-1 blockade. We don't know which is better between PD-1 blockade and brentuximab. If you compare the phase 2 studies head-to-head, there's a sense that perhaps the remissions may be more durable with PD-1 blockade, but that's not something that anybody could say with confidence. That is something that will be tested formally. But I think at this point, whether you do A then B or B then A is not really a fundamental question, I think.
What about toxicity with bevacizumab in your hands using it in relapse disease as you described? What do you see, particularly in terms of peripheral neuropathy? Have you seen anything beyond peripheral neuropathy? And what will trigger you to, you know, hold the drug?
So I see a lot of peripheral neuropathy. And I think, you know, I struggle to remember patients who went through the full course of brentuximab without any neuropathy. Now, most of the time, that's grade 1-2 neuropathy. And so I basically, you know, I follow the general guidelines. I dose reduce for significant neuropathy and eventually stop the drug. It's not common for me to have had to stop the drug for neuropathy. There are a few patients whom I've met who've had really crippling neuropathy from brentuximab. Of course, in those diseases, those are patients who come from previously neurotoxic therapy, like, you know, all of them have had vinca alkaloids in their past. So that is an issue. But, you know, outside of neuropathy, I think brentuximab tends to be well tolerated. It's a relatively easy drug to give. So I think it's a manageable toxicity profile, but there's definitely neuropathy for sure.
I want to ask you about the clinical situation of the elderly person presenting with Hodgkin lymphoma, old to the point or frail to the point that you just really do not want to give chemotherapy. I'm not sure how often that happens. Maybe you can tell me, but I'm curious, you know, putting kind of cost and reimbursement issues aside, what you think right now is the optimal therapy? We have some data, I think, on bevacizumab with chemotherapy. I don't know if there's anything on PD-1 antibodies up front. You would think that ought to be something that would be interesting to look at.
Right. So there will be, I think this is something that will likely be studied with PD-1 blockade. You're correct. For us, it's a rare population because we are pretty aggressive about giving conventional chemo. So it's very rare to have a patient who cannot get frontline therapy. Patients who can't get anthracycline-based therapy can still be treated with alkylator-based therapy because there are options for that. So if you do it without a clinical trial, for me, it's a very rare patient who cannot get decent conventional treatment. With a clinical trial, of course, it's different. It moves the bar a little bit if there's something interesting to offer those patients instead of ABVD, which we know is toxic in that population and less effective in terms of pulmonary toxicity, cardiac toxicity. So at this point, I think the best data out there is with the combination of brentuximab and dacarbazine. Brentuximab alone is not great in this patient population, and brentuximab bendamustine, again, seems to be quite toxic. Brentuximab dacarbazine may be a good middle ground where it's better than brentuximab alone, but not too toxic. That, you know, as you know, we don't have a lot of mature data on that. I think that would be an option, cost issues aside, in someone who really can't tolerate effective frontline therapy. But I think the expectations have to be clear. This is not a regimen that we're giving with the hope of curing 80% of patients like ABVD in a younger patient. So I don't think we should think of this regimen as being a replacement for maybe BVD. Just in someone who can't tolerate it, maybe an option.
So I want to talk about one of your cases that you brought in with Hodgkin lymphoma. You're a young man with classical Hodgkin lymphoma. Can you talk a little bit about how this patient presented and sort of what happened?
Right. So this is, as you know, a young man who presented with advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma, was treated with what is still the standard of care for us, which is ABVD, and actually had primary refractory disease, and then went on to conventional salvage with ICE, obtained a PR, and then went on to GND, which is an interesting question in the field. In lymphoma in general now is whether patients with PR should be taken to auto transplant straight or to further therapy, but that may be a topic for another day.
Before you go, I'm curious what your answer to that question is.
I typically take them to auto and PR. I personally think that the achievement of CR is a reflection of chemosensitivity. So I think the reason those patients do better with auto, which is just chemo, is because they have more chemosensitive disease. I don't think that trying to get those patients in CR, once they've demonstrated that they have a PR only, is going to improve their outcome. So what happens is we select patients, if we go that route, if we take a patient PR and say, okay, we know that patient's going to have an inferior prognosis with auto, let's try to get him to CR. What happens is there are a subset of patients who will achieve CR, but it's a selected subset. It's the subset of patients with more chemosensitive disease amid the PR patients. There's going to be another subset of patients who don't achieve remission and who won't be able to go to auto. So yes, the outcome of auto in the patients who achieve a subsequent CR will likely look better, but that's because it's a subset of them. That's how I read the literature. It's not, you know, one can interpret it the other way, but that's at least personally my take on it. So I feel like if we have the opportunity to go to auto transplant, we know the outcomes are not going to be as good, but it's probably the best we can do. So I take those patients to auto.
So this patient actually, as you say, got GND, right, still was not in CR, went to transplant, relapsed within a couple of months, refractory to radiotherapy. Before we go on, just to take a step back, how often do you see this level of refractoriness in HL, and what do you know about the biology involved?
So not often. This is definitely a rare event. As you know, most patients with Hodgkin lymphoma, fortunately, are cured with frontline therapy. And of the ones who aren't, probably about half of them may be cured with salvage and autotransplant. So it's really a minority of patients who fall into this situation. And we don't really know what the biology is. It's interesting, now we're starting to study whether the biology of PD-1 may actually be prognostic for patients. And there's some suggestion of that already, that patients who have high-level genetic dysregulation may conceivably do worse with just regular conventional chemo, frontline chemo. But that needs probably a little bit of confirmation. But in this case, we don't know why this particular patient's Hodgkin lymphoma was so ill-behaved. And we see this periodically, and in general, it does not bode well, as you can imagine.
And I see this patient did get a PD-1 blockade on clinical trial. Which drug, incidentally?
This was nivolumab.
And that he had a CR. What was his condition before he got the nivolumab? Where was the disease? What was his performance status?
So it actually wasn't bad. Fortunately, he was a young and healthy guy and went through all these treatment with relatively minimal toxicity. He had stage 4 disease at the time that he went on trial. He had disease involving the liver, but he was a good performance status and good organ function.
And how quickly did the response occur?
Quickly. So we, on the Nivo study, there was a quick look, and actually most of the patients achieved response within the initial 8 weeks of treatment. The majority of patients have responded by the 12-week time point, but we do see some delayed CRs. And I think this patient was not in CR until later in his treatment course. So his first restaging was a PR.
How did he do in terms of toxicity? Any issues at all?
Not at all.
Just out of curiosity, I always ask this when people talk about PD-1 antibodies, is the issue of pseudoprogression. It's been discussed in a lot of the other cancers. Has it been observed with HL?
Definitely. It's anecdotal, and we don't yet have great tools to capture it, but we're working hard on trying to formalize criteria to categorize those patients appropriately and allow them to stay on study while tracking their outcomes, so that we can, I hope, replicate some of the extensive work that's been done in solid tumors to try to really optimally deploy those drugs. So we've seen it in Hodgkin lymphoma, but it's rare.
So this man goes into CR, and at that point, what were you thinking?
So he was one of the early patients treated with PD-1 blockade. And for me, the goal in that situation, was to get patients to allotransplant. So we know patients who relapsed after auto have no curative options. And we know allo can cure a disappointingly small, but still a portion of patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. So my clinical practice has always been that in a patient who's an allo candidate, if they relapsed after auto, the goal really is to get them to allo. And that's how I started approaching PD-1 blockade. And so some of the early patients who achieved response, I would take him to allotransplant, which is what I did for him. So he went on to allo just because I felt fortunate to achieve a remission.
Just out of curiosity, are there situations where once people respond, they decide they don't want to go ahead with allo? And how do you feel about that?
Yes, and more and more. So what's changed now since this gentleman went to transplant is that now we have longer follow-up data. And so now we're seeing that many of the responses with PD-1 blockade are maintained at a year and a half, two-year follow-up. And that's really changing the way that we approach them, the way that I approach them, because now when I have a conversation with patients and I say, look, we could go to allo now, but this is going to incur a 15% mortality rate from treatment, or maybe even higher, because we're getting the sense that there's increased immune toxicity with allo in that setting, which we can talk about. Or you can stay on this drug, and most people have excellent quality of life on the drug, have good performance status, or in remission, and now all the patients basically choose to stay on drug. It is still a very open question, because the overall allo outcome after PD-1 blockade seemed pretty good. The relapse rate seems low, and we don't know what's going to happen when these patients are followed 5 years. We don't know if those responses are going to be maintained. And if they're not, we don't really know what the effectiveness of salvage is going to be. So it's still a very challenging question and still a controversial one as to whether to take patients who respond to PD-1 blockade to allo. But at least personally, given the toxicity of transplant, the mortality risk, and the apparent durability of responses, the potential to salvage some of the patients who progress after PD-1 blockade and get them to allotransplant at that point, I have more recently really backed off from taking those patients straight to transplant.
How long was this man on the nivolumab before he went to allo?
About 4 months or so.
So you give it to him for 4 months, he's tolerating it well, he's in CR, and then you have to stop it and do the allo, huh?
Correct.
Wow. And you don't even restart it?
No.
So what happened after the transplant? First of all, what happened in terms of GVHD?
So he developed some graft-versus-host disease, not severe graft-versus-host disease, so that was manageable with usual treatment, steroids, etc. And then, unfortunately, he relapsed with his Hodgkin lymphoma, I think about a year and a half after his allotransplant. So that's what happened to him.
And how was he treated once he relapsed? You would think it'd be tempting, although I'm not sure about how it would go, to restart PD-1 antibody.
So it's challenging, and that is, he has two options, really, because fortunately his relapse is relatively indolent. And so right now I'm just watching him with sort of some slight tapering of immunosuppression, and his disease is staying stable, or maybe improving a little bit, suggesting, and that's something that I've seen a fair amount with Hodgkin lymphoma, more so than with other tumors, than other lymphoma patients whom I've taken to transplant. Is there a number of patients who relapse after allo, but have a kind of an equilibrium where their disease is not relentlessly progressive, but is sort of stable to slowly progressive? His is like that. It's been stable to even slightly improving, so he hasn't needed any additional therapy. And the conversations that we have are around the possibility of restarting PD-1 blockade, but of delaying that as long as possible until we can either do this on trial, which would be great, or until we learn more about this, because that's what we need. We need to learn who we can use this in safely, what's the toxicity, etc.